You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Martin Indyk, the Executive Vice President of Brookings. On behalf of everyone here at Brookings, I want to welcome you to the first Brookings debate. Hashtag Brookings debate. I want to thank our audience in the room and those viewing online for joining us this evening. It's very important that all of you vote, and that's how you do it. We need you to vote early, that is now, and then we'll invite you to vote after the debate. The big question we have for ourselves in this, as opposed to the question that you have to answer here, is whether this Brookings debate can actually change minds. So this is the way we will establish it. Brookings is in the ideas business, ideas that impact policy and improve governance. As an institution, we don't take positions on any policy issue, but we do steadfastly defend the independence of our scholars and their right to advocate for their particular points of view, provided, of course, that it's scholarly based. Convening events among top policy thinkers and practitioners has always been a fundamental part of our DNA at Brookings. And as Brookings heads into our centennial year, yes, believe it or not, we will be 100 years young next year, we wanted to promote a smart conversation on big ideas amongst independent experts. So tonight we're launching this new debate series that's not just what we hope will be an interesting and thought-provoking way to spend an evening, but also a way to hear top minds debate the most important issues of the day. We'll be introducing other innovative ways to showcase what a second-century Brookings is going to look like. We hope you'll be active participants in those efforts, as you are going to be this evening. The issue at hand tonight is perhaps the biggest foreign policy question we face today: whether the United States should put boots on the ground in Iraq and or Syria to fight the Islamic State, or ISIS. Tonight, we've got the treat of engaging with some of the top minds in this business in Washington, including Senator Chris Murphy, who's just come down from the Hill to join us, and we're very grateful, Senator, for your participation in this debate. So without further ado, we're going to get the show started. To moderate this debate this evening, we're very glad that Indira Lakshmanan from Bloomberg News has agreed to take on that role. Indira covers foreign policy from Washington from Bloomberg News. She's travelled around the world with Secretary of State John Kerry, where I used to see her at the back of the plane, and with Hillary Clinton. From 2008 to 2010, she wrote the Page 2 Foreign Affairs column for Bloomberg, and the overseas edition of the New York Times. She's reported from 80 countries around the world. Before moving to Bloomberg, she was the Boston Globe's Asia Bureau Chief based in Hong Kong and Shanghai, covering North Korea to Afghanistan. She's also chronicled China's transformation after the death of Deng Xiaoping. And she's been the Boston Globe's Latin America Bureau Chief in Colombia, covering Mexico to Argentina. She joined Bloomberg in 2008 when she was covering the U.S. presidential campaign, traveling with the main presidential candidates. She started her career at the great NPR, where she worked on the foreign desk and covered the transition from dictatorship to democracy in Chile. Magna cum laude from Harvard University and also a graduate student at Oxford University, and therefore very well suited to conduct this debate. Indira, please.
Good evening. evening, everyone. Welcome to the very first Brookings debate. It's really exciting to be part of this. And thank you so much, Martin, for inviting me. On behalf of everyone at Brookings, I really want to thank you for coming in the room. And we have a more than sold out audience here with standing room in the back, which is great, plus those of you who are on online with us. So as Martin has told you already, tonight we're going to be debating one of the most important and divisive issues in American politics and foreign policy today about whether the U.S. should put boots on the ground to fight ISIS. And as Martin explained, in order to gauge the strength of tonight's arguments, we really need to hear from you both before and after the debate. So that's why your voting is so key. And if you haven't done it already, get out your phone or your computer. The pre-debate poll is going to be open for about 5 more minutes, and you can use the online web link, which is right underneath the video player, or you can text to 22333. So tonight's debate is going to be really structured and fast moving. That's the idea. So you're going to hear 5-minute opening statements from each of the panelists. And gentlemen, you're each only going to have 5 minutes for those, so please don't make me start the Oscars music and get the cane to get you off stage. And after the opening arguments, we're going to get into the heart of the debate, where I'm going to moderate a back-and-forth discussion among the debaters, followed by a chance for the audience to participate. So we're going to take as many questions from you as we can, and also online, please tweet to us your questions using the hashtag BrookingsDebate, and we're going to try to take as many of those questions from Twitter as we can. So after the Q&A, voting is going to open again while we listen to the final 2-minute closing statements from each of our debaters. And this is very important. In order to get the voting tallied so we can tell you what the results are tonight, we are going to have to end the voting at the moment that the final speaker ends his statement. So you really have to, make your decision during that fourth person's remarks and vote before we cut him off. So I really liked the video. That was sort of a cool way to set this up. But to just sort of put it in context a little bit more about ISIS, I mean, by now, everyone in this room and watching online has, you know, heard and seen about the images of terror that ISIS has inflicted not only in the Middle East, but by spreading its message around the world. The group now, as we know, has a major stronghold in both Iraq and Syria, controlling over half of Syria and a significant portion of Iraq. But remember that just a year ago, before June of last year, really many people had never even heard of ISIS. Most people who were not area experts or counterterrorism experts had even heard of this group that at the time was somewhat obscure. But they catapulted into the international spotlight not only by overrunning Iraq's second biggest city, Mosul, but also with these horrific images that they spread online of beheadings of foreign hostages, and also more recently the beheadings of the 21 Coptic Christians in Egypt. And so, you know, overrunning communities, enslaving the Yazidis. We're really familiar now with all of their terror. And President Obama, as many of you will recall, last September said, okay, enough, and began with the airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, backed in either word or in deed by a coalition of more than 60 countries. Of course, the United States has been taking the major lead in that. So now we're up to a situation where the U.S. has about 3,000 troops in Iraq, not in Syria, who are advisors and trainers. But we still don't have anyone who's spotting for the airstrikes on the ground that we know of. And the president recently announced that he was going to send another 450 U.S. troops. So for the purposes of this debate tonight, boots on the ground to combat ISIS means a significant increase in current levels of U.S. combat forces with the mission to fight ISIS head on only in Iraq and Syria. So ISIS, of course, has its presence elsewhere in the world, and it has chapters as far away as Yemen, Egypt, Nigeria. But for tonight's debate, we're talking about U.S. military action in Iraq and Syria. Okay, so the polls are going to close shortly. This is your last chance to vote. And can I please ask the panelists to come onto the stage? All right, we have four incredible panelists here, and they all have such long and impressive biographies that I was instructed not to read them all aloud, that you have them in your packages, because I was going to take up too much time otherwise. So please do refer to them. But arguing in favor of U.S. intervention will be Michael Doran and Michael O'Hanlon right here. Arguing against intervention will be Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Jeremy Shapiro. So remember, you have those full impressive bios in your handout. So let's begin. We're first going to hear from Michael Doran, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, specializing in Middle East policy and a former Bush administration official. Take it away, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's great to be back here at Brookings. And it's an honor to debate this topic in the inaugural debate series. In June of 2013, Sarah Palin was asked for her preferred solution to the Syrian civil war, and she said, let Allah sort him out. I call this the Palin Doctrine. And my opponents here, Senator Murphy and Jeremy Shapiro, are adherents of the Palin Doctrine. Now, the fact of the matter is, to a certain degree, the president is as well. The president clearly, if we've watched his body language on this, he clearly has not wanted to commit troops and has done everything that he can to not do it. But circumstances have forced him to take ever greater steps of toward intervention. And I think we have to ask ourselves, before we accept the Palin Doctrine, we have to realize that built into it is the one of two assumptions. A, that we don't actually have vital interests in the Middle East. So I think we have to start from this. Do we have vital interests in the Middle East? And I think everyone is going to agree, of course we have vital interests. And what are those? They're the same ones that we've been talking about for the last 20 years. We want to fight global terrorism. We want to prevent terrorist safe havens. We want to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We want the steady flow of oil at stable prices, and so on and so forth. So that's question one. Because if we're not willing to take military action in order to improve the situation on the ground, then that means we don't have vital interests that we really care about. Or it means that somehow we think that if we don't take action, that events are going to just sort themselves out in some way that is amenable to our interests. And President Obama himself has suggested that this is the case, and some of his top officials have suggested that sooner or later, the Middle East is going to reach an equilibrium. The Saudis and the Iranians are going to cancel each other out. Hezbollah and Al Qaeda are going to cancel each other out. ISIS and the Iraqi state are going to cancel each other out. But clearly, that is also false, and we can see it. Since 2011, the situation has gone bad to worse, with repercussions that I think everybody in this room is familiar with. We've got 250,000 refugees in Syria. We have, 250,000 dead in Syria. We have half the population uprooted. Half the population uprooted, and the population will never ever go back to its homes. Which means it's going to be a hotbed. Those refugee camps are going to be hotbeds of extremism. And also, we have ISIS right at the center of the Arab world. We have a terrorist safe haven, and I think by now, since we have nearly a year of U.S. military action against ISIS, we can see that the strategy is not working. The strategy is not working, and it's not going to work unless we do unless we take action. Now, all of us here, I think all four of us here, know that we do not want to have a massive U.S. intervention, another George W. Bush-style 150,000 U.S. troops invading Iraq. In order to prevent that, however, and to safeguard our vital interests, we have to have allies who will help us with this task. And the problem with the Palin doctrine is that it alienates all of the allies that we need. Because if you look closely at the demographics on the ground, you see it's not just that we need allies, people who are willing in some circumstances to pick up a gun against ISIS. We need Sunni allies, because the population that is the population in the area that ISIS is taking over, in this area from Baghdad to Damascus, is made up of Sunni Arabs. The problem is, and so what we need is, we need forces on the ground that are capable of helping us take and hold territory, to offer the local population the basic security that it needs in order to expel ISIS from the region. We have experience of this. We did this during the surge from 2007 to 2009, and we learned that if we embed with the local population and we provide it security, that it will help us against the extremists. The problem is, our posture in the region right now is alienating all of the Sunnis. Everybody in the Middle, all the Sunnis in the Middle East believe that we are aligned with Iran. They believe this for many different reasons, but the fact of the matter is that on the ground in Iraq, we are serving as the air force of the Shiite militias run by Iran. And in Syria, we are carrying out a policy that refuses to take the fight to Assad.
Okay,
so until we embed with forces on the ground and create a coalition of Sunnis and show the region that we are willing to take the fight to them, we will not get the allies that we need.
Okay. I think I might have to give 20 extra seconds to one of the two of you. So, all right. Next up, thanks a lot, Michael. Appreciate that. We're going to be hearing from Senator Chris Murphy. Senator Chris Murphy, as you all know, is the junior senator from Connecticut. He serves on the Foreign Relations Committee, the Appropriations Committee, and other very important committees. So please, Senator, come tell us.
Thank you.
He actually is someone in this room who has a chance to make a difference in policy, so that's also a good reason to listen.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to switch sides because I don't want to be associated with Sarah Palin. So that swayed me just in and of itself. Thank you very much to Brookings for bringing us together. Tough to do this in 5 minutes, so I'm going to dispense with the pleasantries and try to get right down to it. No greater obligation, no greater responsibility as a United States senator, as a congressman, than deciding whether or not to commit U.S. men and women to a fight abroad. Doesn't get more serious than that. Why do we know that? Because every single one of us who's been in Congress over the last several years has had to go to way too many funerals for men and women who didn't come back, sitting with families who grieved. And so at the outset, you have to be absolutely certain about what your objective is. And I think we should have a conversation here about whether our objective here is to defeat ISIL, or whether, as the United States, our objective is to degrade them to the point where they are no longer a threat to us. I would argue the latter rather than the former. And I think if you believe the former, then you're talking about hundreds of thousands of American troops there to get that job done. But then you have to be absolutely sure that the insertion of American troops is going to get you closer to that outcome, not farther away, and that there is no other way to get to your objective. Because troops, the prospective death of Americans fighting for us, should be your last resort. I don't think that American combat troops in large numbers in the Middle East qualifies either of those tests. And let me tell you three quick reasons why I don't believe that to be so. First, I just don't believe in the feasibility of the mission. Now, if the mission is just putting in enough troops to assist and train the Iraqis, then we have 10 years of experience to tell us that we're not real good at doing that. If 100,000 American troops on an average annual basis couldn't train the Iraqi military to the point that they wouldn't run from ISIS when they marched on places like Mosul, how is a couple thousand additional American troops going to be able to try to correct for the mistakes of a decade of mistakes? Second, if you believe that actually our competence there is to be the forward-facing presence against ISIS, then there's nothing about the last 10 years that tells you that we can accomplish that mission either. Now, yes, if we put 100,000, 200,000 troops, we might be able to win for the period of time that we're there. But it accomplishes all sorts of other goals that are counter to long-term American interests. What our own intelligence community tells us is that when there are large numbers of American troops in the Middle East, it becomes the cause celeb for the international terrorist movement. You want the greatest recruitment tool for ISIS globally? Put tens of thousands of more American troops in the Middle East. That's a calling card for ISIS as they're trying to recruit against us. Second, I'd argue that putting combat troops in the Middle East to fight ISIS frustrates rather than advances our most important goal, which is political reconciliation. Now, ISIS exists in a political and economic vacuum, not a military vacuum. And the argument here goes that so long as Abadi has U.S. troops to rely on to keep ISIS at bay, to keep them out of Baghdad, then there is no pressure for him to really step up and do the things necessary to create an inclusive government. Why do we know that? Because that's the story of the surge. The surge temporarily gained military stability while allowing for Maliki to very quietly marginalize Sunnis in a way that led the country to fall apart. Look what happened in Ramadi. Ramadi got overrun by ISIS for a variety of reasons, but one of them was that Maliki and his government were unwilling to stand up a Sunni military. Why? Because they saw it to be a threat to themselves. If the United States just steps in and says, we'll fight your battles for him, for you, then there's no incentive to actually create an inclusive fighting force that can sustain the test of time. And then lastly, by viewing this simply through a military prism, we provide disincentive for us to invest in the actual tools that are going to provide for long-term economic stability. Here's the quote that I just heard. If we don't take military action, then we don't have vital interests. Now, that presupposes that the only way to advance your interests is through military action. That's ridiculous. In the case of the surge, we gained stability, yes, because we had a lot of troops, but also because we handed out bags of cash throughout the Middle East, throughout Iraq, to tribal Sunni leaders and bought their allegiance to the central government. Now, I'm not arguing to do that again, but it speaks to the fact that if you have a true political and economic program on the ground that are giving economic solutions to Sunni tribal leaders, then that gives them another reason to walk away from ISIS and to the central government. There are other ways to fight ISIS than simple deployment of American combat troops. I hope that that's a big part of our discussion today. I look forward to the debate. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And so timely, too. All right. Next up. Thank you so much, Senator. Next up, we have Michael O'Hanlon, who's going to argue in favor of intervention. Mike is co-director of the Brookings Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence, and he's also director of research on foreign policy at Brookings. Take it away, Mike.
Thank you, Indira. Thank you all. Senator Murphy, it's an honor to have you with us, and I respect very much the resistance and reluctance of the other side here in the debate. I agree with probably 90% of what they've said and are going to say. But let me say why I think we have to do some important things that are more than what we're doing right now. And I'm going to take in my opening remarks the case of Iraq. This is an integrated battlefield. ISIL or ISIS is a threat throughout much of the region, not just Iraq and Syria, but now also parts of Yemen, Libya, and elsewhere. But you need different strategies based on conditions in different countries. What I'd like to advance is the idea that in Iraq, we need roughly 2 to 3 times as many U.S. troops as we have now. So instead of 3,000 to 3,500 or the 4,000 that Mr. Obama seems headed towards, plus or minus, I'm in favor of something in the range of 7 to 10,000. Also, I believe that instead of simply advising and training at the central locations where we are today, we're going to have to get down to the brigade level and not do fighting for these Iraqis in the overwhelming majority of cases, but do on-the-ground advising, because counterinsurgency is tough, and that's the fight they've got coming, and they're not quite ready for it. There are only two specific things I wanted to respond to in regard to what Senator Murphy said, and I think, generally speaking, I would agree with a lot of his assessments, but there are two points I want to challenge. One is that somehow we failed to train the Iraqi military after 10 years. In technical terms, that military wound up a lot better. The problem is the politics all fell apart after we left. And this is not a big critique of President Obama, who I think actually tried to stay and stayed for 3 years during his first term when he had said he would only stay for 16 months. And he essentially followed the Bush administration schedule for leaving. So I am not trying to make some kind of a harsh critique of what Mr. Obama was trying to do in Iraq. But it's the politics that fell apart. Prime Minister Maliki turned out to be a bad guy. And if you want me to keep trying to throw arrows in all directions, let me say that it was the Bush administration that thought he was the right guy. And they promoted him, and they were wrong. Or maybe they were right for a few minutes and then wrong for a long time after that, because Maliki had a brief heyday during the surge, and then he turned out to be a guy who tore the country apart. That's the real failure that we've had. And the Obama administration, therefore, was correct to make their first order of business last summer, convincing the Iraqis to get rid of Maliki. But now we're going to hope that someone even better than Abadi is out there if only we're patient and wait? No. What's going to happen if we wait is that Abadi is going to fall because he's going to fail. Therefore, we have to actually get after this. And the Syria piece of this is so difficult that we have to get progress and momentum going in Iraq. So I think we can do that with roughly 2 to 3 times the number of people. And as I've said, being more forward, using air power as we are already, we've already crossed that threshold. We may have to use it a little bit more in certain specific fights in the cities. Here is one piece that I know will be controversial, and here I'm a little bit more forward-leaning than some of my fellow teammates in this broader debate. I don't know if Michael is exactly in my camp on this, but I believe we should actually preposition American Special Operations Forces for direct action at a moment of our and the Iraqis' choosing once we're ready for a major counteroffensive against ISIL, which will probably be next year, not this year. I would like to see Joint Special Operations Command help in some very hard-hitting and sort of blitzkrieg-style special operations raids, Stan McChrystal raids, where we actually seize the initiative and don't just do this through incrementalism. So I am in favor of having 2,000 or 3,000 American special operations forces involved in several weeks' worth of raids in conjunction with the Iraqis once the moment is right. But the moment isn't right now. And let me finish on the political point. Again, to support Mr. Obama's general strategy, politics come first in Iraq. I agree with Senator Murphy on that, too. The way we have to take this to the next level is to help the Iraqis and push them to create the Iraqi National Guard that's going to allow the Sunni tribesmen and some of the members of some Shia militias and a number of other Iraqis who presently do not want to join the Iraqi army or police to have some role in this fight. Because right now we're unable to attract enough recruits. The Iraqis are not able to bring enough people into their ranks. The whole thing has petered out. We got off to a good start last year with this strategy, and it's petered out. And now, if anything, ISIL has the upper hand slightly again in Iraq. So I think by doubling to tripling our forces, having advisors more forward, being willing to do some special operations raids over a short period when the time is right, and really pushing the Iraqis to take this National Guard concept to the next level so they can bring Sunni tribesmen and other Shia into a concept where they can fight and defend their own homelands, not some general notion of an integrated Iraq that I admit and agree is not really there to be defended right now, but their own homelands with American support for the creation and training of that National Guard, I think we'll be much better off. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Right. That's terrific. So next up, as you know, is Jeremy Shapiro. Jeremy is a fellow with the Project on International Order and Security in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, and he is a former Obama administration official in the Policy Planning Department at State Department.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, and I'd like to say that I guess following up on Mike, I respect their positions, and I guess doing the math, I agree with 10% of what he says. There are two basic reasons, in my view, why large U.S. ground forces are a bad idea in the fight against ISIS. The first is that they're not necessary. The second is that they won't work, and they'll even be counterproductive. So first, why aren't they necessary? You know, ISIS has clearly demonstrated a lot of tactical and operational proficiency, but they're not 10 feet tall. They have many weaknesses. Foremost among them is that everybody hates them. The West hates them. The Kurds hate them. The Iranians hate them. The Sunni powers hate them. And recently, anyone governed by them hates them. Even al-Qaeda hates them. This is an impressive list of enemies, even by Middle Eastern standards. And it really helps explain why ISIS has demonstrated no capacity to expand beyond Sunni Arab areas. They are hopelessly outnumbered by their Shia and Kurdish enemies and facing a restive and angry Sunni population to govern. These enemies, in combination with coalition air power, mean that their expansion is already effectively limited to the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq and Syria. They are stuck in a war of attrition. They can't hope to win, even if they can hold on for a very long time. In the meantime, they're not capable or really even interested in attacks on the United States, despite much heated rhetoric to the contrary. Since 9/11, I would say we have become extremely effective at preventing terrorist attacks that emanate from abroad in this country, despite the endless predictions of such attacks. Our homeland security system is working, and we should appreciate the cushion of security that it provides. ISIS ideology, of course, could inspire individuals within the United States, and let's face it, as the events in Charleston this week demonstrate so tragically, we have a huge problem with isolated, angry young men inspired by whatever ideology resorting to violence and terrorism. But a recent FBI report documented 160 mass shootings over the last 13 years in the United States, resulting in nearly 500 deaths. None had any operational connection abroad. Only two, both lone wolves, were inspired by foreign Islamist ideology. So ISIS could disappear tomorrow, or it could take Baghdad tomorrow, and it wouldn't appreciably change this problem. We should do something about this violence, but invading Iraq or Syria is not it. The second point is that U.S. ground forces will not solve the problem that ISIS represents. All agree that ISIS is a symptom of the political and sectarian struggles in Iraq and Syria. U.S. ground troops can likely inflict military defeats on ISIS, but to what purpose? Let's recall we just spent 9 years occupying Iraq with ground forces, fruitlessly trying to create the inclusive political order that Mike wants, and in the process spawning ISIS from U.S. military prisons. Without progress by local actors on the political front, defeating ISIS militarily will mean nothing. Another, perhaps worse, group will simply arise. Of course, various people in Washington, a lot of them named Mike, will tell you that now we understand the mistakes of the past, that now we know how to create an inclusive political order in Iraq and Syria, that the problem was the stupidity of the Bush administration, the Obama administration, that all we have to do is support this politician or arm this militia, that now, after more than a decade of trying and more than $25 billion in taxpayer money, we have got the politics right so we can train an effective Iraqi security forces that won't crumble or Syrian opposition forces that won't betray us. Well, I say buyer beware. This is not just a question of political will or strategy. The record of political engineering efforts in the Middle East is quite dismal. In this case, the fundamental problem is that besides the Kurds, we lack effective allies in both Iraq and Syria, and we cannot rebuild these states by ourselves. We have to acknowledge that the United States does not come to these countries without baggage. We have a long and troubled history in the region. We've invaded or occupied or bombed 12 Islamic countries in the broader region since 1980, with precious little goodwill to show for it. Listen to the views of our most recent hope for an effective Sunni ally in Iraq, Prime Minister Abadi, whom the U.S. helped to put into power last year. On the very question of U.S. ground troops, he said, quote, "We don't want them. We won't allow them. Full stop. Any foreign ground troops on Iraqi soil will be treated as enemy troops." That's our ally. Our enemies, and they are legion in Iraq and Syria, will probably be even less hospitable. So in short, U.S. ground forces are not necessary to deal with the problem of ISIS. They're not capable of dealing with the problem that ISIS represents, and they might make the problem worse.
Okay. I appreciate the discipline, gentlemen, other than Mike Durant. So I've got my eye on you. I definitely have my eye on you. All right. Now comes fantastic opening arguments, both sides. Thank you, gentlemen. And we're now going to move over to a section that I'm going to keep tight at 25 minutes, where we're going to sort of have discussions and arguments amongst our panelists. So I'm going to pick out some of the things that struck me when I was listening, and I did not know what these gentlemen were going to be saying before they said it. So I'm just going to say what is coming to my mind. And I was struck by something that Senator Murphy said about what is the objective. for the United States in Iraq and Syria? Are we trying to defeat or degrade ISIS? And the senator said that our objective should be to degrade. So I'd like someone from the other team to take that up. Is that the correct objective?
No, the objective is to defeat ISIS. And the president said that we should degrade and ultimately defeat. And when the president of the United States makes such a statement, it should have an effect. It should have an effect on our enemies, and it should have an effect on our allies. And it should be immediate. There's a very serious prestige issue here when the president of the United States says that he's going to go out to defeat a force of 20 to 30,000 guys, nasty guys with pickup trucks, puts together a coalition of some 60 members and starts bombing them, and after 8 months shows no appreciable effect. It's very dangerous for the prestige of the United States in the Middle East and across the region. And one of the problems that we have as a result of that is that our allies start to assume that we cannot do the job, and they make choices of their own, which are as damaging to us as some of the choices that our enemies are making.
Okay, Senator Murphy, that's a powerful argument, that it's our prestige as a nation that is at stake, and that people aren't going to take us seriously in the Middle East, neither our friends nor our enemies, if we don't stand up and put our money where our mouth is. What do you say to that?
Well, is our prestige greater today than before the war in Iraq? Do we have more friends in the region than we did prior to putting in hundreds of thousands of troops in the region? Are our interests advanced because of the mistakes that we made? Of course not. We lost prestige through the mistakes that were inherent in a strategy that believed that the United States military could ultimately solve political problems on the ground in the Middle East. Now, it is my desire that the Red Sox win tonight, but it is not my objective, because ultimately it's the players on the field that are going to determine as to whether or not the Red Sox win. That's why I'm saying today that I freely admit that it is my desire that ISIL is ultimately eliminated. And I can be, as a United States senator, a participant and someone who provides an assist in that overall effort. But it's the decision of leaders on the ground in the territory that ISIS operates in and occupies as to whether they are ultimately eliminated. And so that's why I think it's important to talk about the distinctions and talk about what the United States has control over and what we don't, because I think that the damage that we have done to our prestige over the last 10 years is rooted in a fundamental misunderstanding over what we have control over as a nation, and in particular, what our United States military has control over.
All right. The senator makes a powerful argument that we can't, you know, just wish for something to happen and make it be so, that the long, painful history in Iraq under George W. Bush showed us that that didn't work. So, Mike, I'm struck by the use of the word ultimately, that we want to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL. And I wonder whether the other side is essentially kicking the can down the road. Is the president himself kicking the can down the road? If he says ultimately, we know he's not going to be in office for that much longer. Is this going to become the next president's problem? And take that up.
Well, I think we all know this will be the next president's concern as well, regardless of our prescriptions for what that president might have to do. I would be content to see the situation in Iraq changing dramatically by the end of the Obama administration, with some inroads in Syria. I think that is a realistic goal. I also think that, frankly, it's necessary, because I think Jeremy did a brilliant job of correctly noting that we have not suffered attacks on the homeland from ISIL or al-Qaeda in any substantial size or magnitude since 9/11. But I don't take that as a given indefinitely. I think we've gotten lucky a few times. We've had a few attacks, by the way, some of which didn't work out so well for the attacker, like the underwear bomber on Christmas Day 2009, that might have. We've also seen a Charlie Hebdo attack inspired not by ISIL but by al-Qaeda, perhaps, but the broader jihadist movement in France. We've seen the possibility of lone wolf attacks in the United States. And most of all, there's a very distinct possibility that Assad's going to fall this year due to ISIL. I'm not going to cry too much over that development if it happens, but I am going to worry about what ISIL's ambitions become next. Is it going to be Jordan? Are they going to try to sneak in assassination teams against a Middle East leader that we value? Are they going to start thinking about attacking Baghdad or Kurdistan and Iraq, like they tried last year? I think the idea of assuming that this is just sort of contained and containable indefinitely at the current level of effort is a big assumption. We don't know that's correct. If it were correct, then we could trade off our humanitarian concern for the Syrian people and our responsibility to protect under UN and humanitarian law against our desire not to send American men and women into combat. And that would be a tough debate. But I worry about where this threat could go in the next year to 3 years. And I think we better not, you know, better not assume that for 5 to 10 more years of it burning out, we're going to be okay throughout that whole process.
Jeremy, you know, 5 to 10 more years, take yourself a little bit into the future. You made the argument that everybody hates ISIS, that including al-Qaeda, who kicked them out and said, you're too mean to be in our terrorist club, you got to go. If everyone hates ISIS so much, why haven't they gone away? Why haven't they been defeated? I didn't hear in your argument where you said how they're going to be defeated just because everyone hates them.
Thanks. And the Red Sox are going to win tonight. So that's a prediction I'll make. But why haven't ISIS been defeated? You know, I don't really know. I think that the one of the things that we should have learned from our experience in Iraq and Syria is that we don't really very well understand the dynamics on the ground. There is, as people have said, a lot of Sunni resentment against. There's sort of different stories in Iraq and Syria, so I could run through them. But in Iraq, there is a lot of Sunni resentment against the Shia government, and they were willing to take in to even accept the idea of an ISIS conquest as perhaps superior to the Shia government that they felt was oppressing them in Iraq. I think by now ISIS has disabused them of that view. In Syria, they simply profited from the dynamics of the Syrian civil war and the confusion that was there. I think, you know, I don't mean to underestimate ISIS. I think that they have accomplished a lot more than anybody thought they could, and they have demonstrated particularly a lot of tactical and operational proficiency. But we have a tendency as a country, as an analytical community, to sort of see a trend and to project it off into the future. And trends don't usually go that way. Usually they contain the seeds of their own ending. And might say, well, you know, maybe ISIS will conquer Libya and Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and maybe there will be an attack next year in the United States sponsored by them. I think, you know, I can't 100% rule these things out. But analytically, it's not likely. And I'd like to base our policy on not the worst-case scenario I can understand, what Ron Suskin called the 1% doctrine, but on what I think is actually likely to happen.
All right. Michael Duran, you have referred in your writing to this subject as being similar to Eisenhower doing a head fake during the Dien Bien Phu crisis. And even though he coined the term, the domino theory, you say that he actually wasn't urging American intervention. He was trying to do everything to ensure it didn't happen. So tell us about the other Vietnam term, mission creep. So how do we know that if we start sending these American troops as spotters or, you know, some fighters, that it's not going to get completely out of control like I think you agreed the Iraq War did?
That's a great question. Thanks. I think the key issue there is allies. Jeremy's being disingenuous when he says we don't know why a coalition of 60 forces and why all of the states who hate ISIS haven't succeeded in destroying ISIS. And the answer is simple. The Sunnis need to know. The Sunnis on the ground in Iraq, on the ground in Syria, and the surrounding Sunni states, they need to understand that the war against ISIS is going to result in a regional order that protects their vital interests and that doesn't benefit Iran. And when they look at the trend lines, and when they look at the trend lines of U.S. policy across the region, they believe that if they participate wholeheartedly in the U.S. project against ISIS, they're going to be handing the region to Iran. So until we convince the Sunnis of the states in the region and the Sunnis on the ground that we have their interests in mind, then the only option that we are going to have in the event of a severe crisis is unilateral U.S. action of a massive kind. If we want to have any other levers to use to throw at this problem, we have to generate allies. It is generating allies that allows us to avoid mission creep, but that requires a certain amount of American military commitment.
So when you say of a massive kind, define how many U.S. troops you think need to be there.
I'm saying I go with what Mike said. I would probably put it a little bit higher. But we're talking about.
He said 7,000 to 10,000.
We're talking about 4 or 5 times what we've got now. But partly because I want to be very careful, because I recognize one of the reasons why President Obama doesn't actually want to do what he says he's doing is that he fears that if he starts to actually make serious inroads against ISIS on the ground in Iraq, it is going to be threatening to the Shiite militias dominated by Iran, and Iran is going to start taking retribution against us. So
we're going down the Iran rabbit
hole.
In addition to the forces that
Mike wants to put in place, we have to have some extra for force protection purposes.
Okay, so you're talking about 12,000 to 15,000 is the general number you're giving. Okay. Senator Murphy, you know, I'm struck by the passion with which you talk about how we can't make the same mistakes that we made in the Iraq War under George W. Bush, and how strongly you've advocated, even to the point of getting an amendment onto the NDAA, into the defense authorization, I believe, an amendment that would bar American troops on the ground. And I had heard that you were also seeking a similar amendment on some other legislation. But it's interesting because a wide array of polls recently consistently show that Americans do support U.S. military action and boots on the ground against ISIS. So how do you justify your opposition to this to your own constituents and other American voters?
My constituents in Connecticut are very scared of ISIS, and rightly so. I mean, we haven't seen this kind of vicious, inhumane, unconscionable behavior in a long time, certainly not on our TVs every night. I do believe that they are a threat to the United States, and maybe not in credible attacks that are being planned today, but certainly to the extent they get control of a large swath of territory there uncontested, they've made it clear that the United States would be in their sights. And so that's why I actually support a robust mission to, as I say, degrade them to the point where they don't have an impact against the United States. But those polls also have one thing in common, which is that they only give the American people one option, which is put American troops on the ground. There isn't an alternative in those polls. And I would argue that if you asked an alternative question, which proposed a strategy in which the United States is providing the air cover and training as we are today for the Iraqi forces, that we have a realistic strategy to provide an economic answer to the marginalization of those in Sunni areas, that they would support that before they supported ground troops. But they only get one choice. And when faced with do nothing against this vicious enemy or support ground troops, some of these polls suggest they support ground troops. And so I just think everything we should be thinking about is in terms of how we solve the political vacuum on the ground. And I don't think that we have had a real honest conversation with American voters about an alternative plan to troop deployment that does that.
Okay, the senator is admonishing all the pollsters amongst you to design better polls with better questions that aren't so binary. The senator also, in his opening remarks, Mike O'Hanlon, talked about how the best tool for recruitment for ISIS is more U.S. troops, that there is no single better advertisement for them, that they can put it out on social media and, you know, draw even more than the thousands of foreign fighters who are coming now. So that's a pretty powerful argument, that we're only going to make ISIS stronger if we put U.S. troops on the ground.
Well, empirically, I think that that was true in Iraq in the worst of the Civil War period, but I think it's not been true in the Syrian Civil War, where roughly 1,000 foreign jihadists from nearly 100 countries had been flocking to this country every month for the last couple of years in the absence of an American presence on the ground. And much of the reason, and I've learned this from my good friends in our Brookings Doha Center, like Salman Sheikh, who's here tonight, and Charles Lister and Will McCann's here at Brookings, there's this notion of this sort of mythical, romantic, great apocalyptic fight that's going to happen in Syria, where fundamentalist Islam is going to defeat its enemies. And that's why they began with the name ISIS or ISIL. There's something about this fight that is special to them, this place that's special to them. And we're not part of the draw. So they're still bringing in 1,000 people a month without us there. So personally, I don't find that argument, compelling one way or the other, because it's true that we did help draw them in Iraq, but we're not the ones that are helping draw them to Syria. So I just start with a clean sheet of paper. And I say, can we design a mission that does, in response to your earlier question and the senator's very valid concerns, prevent the likelihood or the potential of mission creep? And this 7,000 to 10,000 number that I've been advocating tonight for Iraq, I calculated a year and a half ago before we sent the first 3,000, and I stood by it. I still think it's the right number because it's enough to put advisors in the field at the brigade level, do tactical air control, and have some special forces. And if it doesn't work quickly and it takes a while, then I'm enough with Jeremy's argument, believe it or not, that I would be patient because I agree that Jeremy and the senator are right, that we actually have to make Iraqis do this for themselves. And if their politics aren't in a place where they can do 95% of the fighting, we're just going to have to be as patient as we possibly can. But it's scary to be patient in dealing with ISIL. It is scary. I'm a little scared every day about what they might do next. And I think we have to get away from the notion that just because yesterday was relatively tranquil for the West, that and that I personally do not agree with Jeremy's argument that what's happened in the last few weeks is the best predictor of what will happen in the next few weeks and the soundest basis for policy. ISIL has a very ambitious goal. That's why they call themselves the Islamic State. They want to be a caliphate throughout the broader Middle East region. And someday they may, in addition, escalate their attempted attacks against the West.
Michael's been generous to concede some of our points, so let me tell you the most persuasive of his, which is this idea that the way in which you influence the central government in Baghdad to make the concessions necessary to build political inclusiveness is to embed more forces with the Iraqis. I understand that argument. I understand that argument, and I understand why it's persuasive to some. The question is, how much more influence do you get by moving from 3,000 to just 10,000? And are there other ways to gain that influence? Now, I'm not saying there are the votes for this in the United States Congress, but if you were to propose to a body a multi-billion-dollar economic development plan that he could that he could have some say and oversight over in Sunni areas, would that be enough to make him consider those concessions? But I grapple with this question of whether or not we can force them to make these decisions without a greater number of troops. And if I was ever to believe the opposite of my argument, that would likely be the reason why I'd get there.
Do you want to give a very quick response to Mike's point that he didn't buy your argument that more U.S. troops would actually be a recruitment tool for ISIS? Do you have any empirical evidence that it has been?
Well, you clearly know that it was in Iraq, and he's right, that we have evidence to suggest that when Americans enter the Middle East, it dramatically increases the numbers of people who want to come and fight. And to the extent that ISIS is building this expectation that Syria is going to be the end-all and be-all of the fight for a caliphate and between their brand of Islam and the rest of the world, there is nothing that could be a better advertisement for the fulfillment of that dream than the United States having significant combat troops on the ground. But I will concede that they haven't had to wait for that thus far. I don't necessarily think that the fact that they have had other reasons to recruit people into the fight should be a reason for us to ignore the very clear historical evidence that tells us that we are just fuel, not water, to that fire.
Okay. Jeremy, your debate partner took the prerogative of being a senator to jump in there, but I won't forget you. We'll come back to you on the next round. Okay, Mike Duran.
I'll run for office in the meantime.
Yes, please. All right, Mike Duran. Even Senator Mitch McConnell opposes U.S. boots to fight in Iraq and Syria. Even he says, no, we need local boots on the ground. So to find a prominent politician who, aside from John McCain, who unequivocally supports the idea of sending U.S. troops into Iraq, we really have to look to an ex-president. George W. Bush has come out on the record saying this. So after the entire fiasco in Iraq with the Iraq War, how can we trust his judgment or yours?
You can.
I'm not debating. I'm just asking. I'll give them a zinger too.
No, you can.
Let's just stand on that.
You can trust my judgment because we had very significant experience and we learned from our mistakes in Iraq, and as I said in my opening comments, we learned from the surge. The surge is a tremendous success. And it showed that, I mean, there, in Middle Eastern populations have these broad, we talk about them in these broad, these broad categories like Sunnis and Shiites. But they, their politics is profoundly local, in the end. And what we found is that when we embed people with local forces who are fighting for their homes, and their locales, and we have we engage with them frequently, and we engage with them steadily. We develop reliable allies that can help us against the against enemies like this. And it was that learning experience that the Bush administration went through that allowed the Bush to turn the war around in Iraq. But President Obama learned completely different lessons from Iraq, and he came to the kind of conclusions that Sarah Palin and my and our colleagues across the aisle here came to. And as a result of that, we see the situation going from bad to worse. The trend lines, you know, as Mike mentioned, we were all arguing, all of us who think this way were arguing a year ago that if we don't take action, the situation is going to get worse. And the people who think, like Jeremy said, don't worry about it. And in fact, it's gotten worse. And now, according to a Quinnipiac poll in March, a decisive majority of Americans want boots on the ground in Iraq and Syria. So opinion has changed significantly.
All right. Well, don't influence our audience here. We'll see what our own audience thinks after this debate. So, Jeremy, Mike Duran says that he and other Bush administration officials learned from their mistakes. So we've got some rehabilitated policymakers here. So you tell us, you worked in the policy planning department at State, and if boots on the ground are such a bad idea, why didn't you guys come up with some alternative that could work?
I think I mentioned in my opening talk that a guy named Mike would tell us that we had learned the lessons and that we now knew what to do. So I already feel a little bit vindicated. I think it's important to understand when sort of hearing this idea that the surge had sort of brought peace and Jeffersonian ideals to Iraq before Obama ruined it, that what really this surge accomplished. I mean, I'll quote from a retired Lieutenant General, Daniel Bolger, who just wrote a book called Why We Lost, The General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. He said, "The surge didn't win anything. It bought time. It helped reduce violence, but it created no political reconciliation, and so was just biding time." And that's, I think, what we're talking about here, is that we don't have the capacity to do the political engineering that we all agree is necessary, and that military forces, as Senator Murphy has been emphasizing, are not the way to accomplish that, if there is any way. And so in the absence of that, what we can do is send in forces. We can pay the very steep costs for doing that. We can perhaps reduce violence over time, but we are unlikely to push toward that political reconciliation. In matter of fact, we may well, as we have in the past, make it worse, and we will be back right in the same situation where we are. I don't think of that as having learned the lessons of the past few years. I like to think, you know, that when we say generals are often fight the last war, we're talking metaphorically, but in this case, it seems like we're actually talking about literally fighting the last war.
Okay, Mike O'Hanlon, you wrote last month, you called for training and equipping anti-Assad forces in Syria, even those who you yourself called questionable actors. So some of those questionable actors, of course, are ideologically close to ISIS, this group that we want to defeat. So I wonder, understand exactly how your policy plan works. How is it that by helping those people, are we not just cutting off our nose to spite our face, helping ISIS get stronger?
Well, again, my good friend Salman Sheikh has taught me a lot about the Syrian opposition, as have a number of other scholars. And it's a very complex, shifting group of shifting collection of many groups. And I think it's very hard to figure out which ones are going to be dependable partners over time. I concede that point. But I also think that we've applied at least two or three different thresholds, and only one of which I think is completely valid. And when we've tried to vet forces or groups that we would operate with, the threshold that I do agree with is the notion that if somebody is of an al-Qaeda-like philosophy, we can't work with them. And I'm completely on board that al-Nusra and any remnants or elements of ISIL cannot be partners for the United States.
So who are the questionable elements you're talking about?
But the ones who fought with bad guys temporarily because there was no other way to stay alive on the battlefield because the United States did not back up its promises to come help its allies. And meanwhile, everybody else did help their allies. Those people have to be forgiven or at least given a second chance because staying alive is allowable. Making a decision to tactically stay alive because you are otherwise overwhelmed and therefore you may have to temporarily affiliate with some pretty nasty groups, that's something we have to be willing to think about and give people a second chance. So a vetting program that applies both those standards, both those thresholds against which any group would have to pass before it can be entered into an American training program is simply unrealistic and the wrong way to go.
Okay, Senator Murphy, last one in this round before we turn to the audience questions. So just quickly take up for us, in your remarks, you talked about the mission that these gentlemen on the other side of the stage are advocating is just not feasible, and that the whole 10 long years of the Iraq War shows we're not good at what it is that they want to do. But I want to hear from you really what your plan is for how the Iraqis on the ground or these putative Syrians on the ground, who we don't even know who our real allies are in Syria, as Mike O'Hanlon concedes, how are we going to find these people who are actually going to degrade and defeat ISIS so that they're not a threat to us?
Well, first, I think it's important to set the right expectations. I think to demand that the United States be able to have a coherent plan to defeat ISIL in Iraq and Syria without serious partners, as I would argue we don't have now, is difficult, if not impossible. And so the construct can't be if you don't have a coherent, winning, non-military plan that you can articulate today, then we have to put in ground troops. That can't be the default position. But I will just say this. I actually have supported the president's insertion of, up to 4,000 troops. And I have confidence that we're not on a slippery slope so long as President Obama is in office. What I would have liked to have seen is a little bit more hard bargaining before the insertion of those troops. And what I mean by that is that this was a moment of leverage that we could have used to try to get Abadi to do the things that he's been telling us he's going to do for a long time, like stand up a Sunni National Guard, something that the Foreign Relations Committee has been told is just on the precipice of happening for the entire 2.5 years that I've been on the committee. Or I'd like us to make a real commitment to the other kinds of assistance that really make a difference. I mean, it's ridiculous that we are now on the verge of letting the World Food Program run out of money for the second time in a row. This is the program that feeds all the Syrian refugees, that provides them an alternative to signing up with ISIS, who would give them a paycheck and a handful of square meals for them and their family. But we aren't even talking about making a full commitment to that program either. So if you're driving a harder bargain to make them make the political choices necessary, if you're funding the kind of economic and humanitarian program that undercuts ISIL, and you are being a military partner to the extent that I think is practicable, which is air campaigns, limited on-the-ground training, not putting U.S. troops at risk, all of which would be, by the way, authorized by the limitation on ground forces that I've proposed because it has built in a bunch of these exceptions, then I think ultimately that's a plan that can keep ISIS on the run to the extent that the political decisions can be made to ultimately eliminate them. But it starts with being honest about what your capabilities are and what your objectives are.
Very timely, your reference to the AUMF. I think you were actually discussing that on the Hill right before coming here, which is why we started just a little bit late, but we can give the senator a pass on that since he was actually dealing with policy on the very issue that we're debating. All right, so we're going to turn it over to the audience now. I'm going to reset my trusty timer. Okay, so I've got my eye on you guys too. So let's open it up. If you have a question, raise your hand, wait till the microphone comes to you, and then please identify yourself and your affiliation. And please remember, we need concise questions from you. It needs to be a question, not a statement, or I'll have to redirect. So let's start with Saeed.
Thank you, Indira. My name is Saeed Erekat. I'm a Palestinian journalist, but I also spent 5 years in Iraq during the surge time, and I can tell you no amount of troops will really impact the situation on the ground. My question is to Senator Murphy. I believe, you know, and all indications are that to really defeat and degrade ISIS is for the United States to pressure its allies in the Gulf states and Turkey to stop aiding, financing, and arming these groups. Why not introduce legislation or political efforts, whatever you want to call it, in the United States Senate, in Congress, to actually do just that, to pressure the GCC countries, to pressure Turkey to quit aiding and arming ISIS? Thank you.
Well, Senator. One of the ways in which we have been successful in degrading ISIS has been through that very initiative. Now, I don't claim that we have cut off all of their sources of funding, but there has been a significant diminution of those sources of funding because of the pressure that we have leveraged. But absolutely, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think that that is a perfectly appropriate way for the United States Congress to take a more fulsome role than we have, stepping up to the plate and putting more pressure on those countries to do the right thing. But you see evidence in which the leaders of the Senate are moving in the opposite direction. We had a proposal last week for United States to begin directly arming the Kurds. Now, there's a lot of reasons why you should provide arms to the Kurds, but there are other means to do that other than giving it directly to the Kurdish state, which, by the way, would create enormous problems in Turkey, which would undercut your efforts to try to get Turkey to work with you on other problems within the region. So I do think that we have to have an overall strategy that gets more buy-in from our regional partners. Sometimes I don't think we see the big picture, and when we think we're helping somebody like the Kurds, we don't understand that ultimately we might be frustrating some of our other goals in and around the region with our partners. But no, I don't let my colleagues off the hook for perhaps not using the pressure points that we could for those reasons.
Okay, we're going to take another question, and please also tell us to whom you are directing it or to which team, and they can decide amongst themselves. Yes, the young lady.
My question is directed.
Please identify yourself. Thanks.
My name is Eva Marie. I'm a student at Bard College and captain of the debate team there.
Oh, okay, so you can give these guys pointers afterwards. Just take them aside, give them any tips. They'll appreciate it.
So my question is for the affirmative side, which promotes boots on the ground. We've seen a lot of dissension over whether putting forces on the ground will increase Islamic State recruitment. But looking more towards the longer term, how do you address Senator Murphy's argument that even in the best case scenario, if IS is defeated, a new group will step in? How do you sort of break the cycle of intervention, extremism, and terrorism through boots on the ground?
Okay, affirmative side. She's holding your boots to the fire. Let's hear it.
The cycle of extremism that we see is partially a result of us pulling back. If the United States doesn't step in and present the states of the region, and particularly the Sunni states of the region, a vision of regional order that is that can take care of their security. Challenges and that will safeguard their vital interests, then they turn to the tools that they have at their disposal to take care of their problem. One of those tools, I disagree with the previous question that the Gulfies are really supporting ISIS. We have lots of information about where ISIS money and recruitment comes from, and it's not coming directly from the Gulf states. But one of the tools that the surrounding states do have is they turn a blind eye to what's going on in that territory. They don't really do enough to stop it, because if their choice is between ISIS and an Iran-dominated Middle East, then they're not going to come to our aid, and they're going to leave the field open to these jihadis.
All right, another question. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Ahmed Musa. I'm a graduate student at the Middlebury Institute, and a question for the mics.
Mike and Mike. The M&Ms.
Oh, I'm curious. I guess I have two questions. The second one is, I guess, more important to me. But one, why not just use airstrikes more effectively in Iraq and Syria? And number two, if we were to put U.S. troops in Syria and their primary objective was to fight ISIS, what happens when they run into other groups, for example, Jabhat al-Nusra? Especially when those groups, you know, Jelani in his Al Jazeera interview said that Jan's not interested right now in fighting the West. But, like, couldn't that change that mentality?
Michael Hanlon, can you take that one?
Two things. First, we didn't talk a lot about details of any of our Syria plans, but I would not suggest putting in a lot of U.S. forces to be the primary combatants in Syria. The main place where I think I disagree from the other team is I would support, once we have an opposition that can establish a foothold and survive with that foothold, probably starting with the Kurds in the north, adding American special forces to then accelerate the training that you would try to use to expand that group's hold and over time allow it to expand its foothold, and do that ideally in conjunction with our regional allies, some of whom should also be willing to put in such special forces. So that's essentially what I'm arguing in regard to Syria. In regard to air campaigns, let me just bring it back to the Kosovo War. In 1999, we bombed, we did some pinpricks, then we picked it up a bit. We went from a few dozen airplanes to a few hundred airplanes. Still no way to win the war from the air. We were flying at a certain altitude that was higher, perhaps, than we're flying now. The bottom line is, when you just try to use air power in this antiseptic, you know, wonderful way from standoff, it's not very good, especially against a group like ISIL. Because what won the Kosovo War was ultimately targeting parts of Belgrade that Milosevic, who was not looking for happiness in the afterlife so much as power and money in this life, what he valued. And we went after him and his cronies and what they held. ISIL is going to be a lot harder to target and dissuade in that way. So you're going to have to beat them on the ground. The question is, how do we get regional partners ready to do that fight for themselves with American help? That's, I think, a point we would all agree on. I just think it's going to take more American help and a little bit more in the way of numbers and risk than the other side.
So America is the leading edge. Okay.
Not
the leading edge.
The example.
It's primarily a catalyst to the training
the
of these forces,
example.
And then we do some direct raids with them in a limited phase.
Okay, let me ask the negative team, is it okay with you if Mike Duran makes a point? All right, go for it. He's been helping you. Okay.
Mike was very modest, and he didn't mention that he has a paper on Syria that goes into detail on some of this on Brookings' website.
All right. Hashtag Brookings debate. All right. Yes, I see a question in the back.
Hi, I'm Colin Steele, and I work at Georgetown. And I have two questions for the anti-side, especially Mr. Shapiro. And that is, first, could you talk a little bit about your analysis of U.S. social resilience in terms of our ability to control our own fears, essentially? And secondly, talk a little bit about what specifically we must absolutely prevent. And that gets a little bit to the distinction between what don't we like in terms of humanitarian crises and what must we absolutely prevent, whether that's, for example, capturing WMD or taking over Baghdad or what have you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, those are pretty broad questions. I'll try to attack them a little bit. The question of social resilience, I think, is a really important one. Maybe you've been reading it, but I've been writing on that a little bit. And it seems to me that that is the fundamental problem we have, that on a certain level, we externalize these problems because our politicians don't want to deal with trying to tell people, you know, you have to bear up to some of these problems. So it's very easy to sort of say, well, what we're going to do to deal with terrorism is to send the military abroad, and the U.S. military is something that we can have faith in, and it'll get the job done. And it seems like a response that obviates our need to sort of to sit around and think about, you know, how much violence can we actually absorb? What are we actually willing to take? We've never had that debate. The standard is one of absolute protection. And I think that has made our debate a little bit difficult to have here. In terms of your question about what we absolutely must prevent, I think that we do have vital interests in the Middle East. In the first instance, it is preventing terrorist attacks from coming to our shores. I think we have that fairly well in hand, but it's certainly something that we absolutely must prevent. Even if we can't be 100% successful. And I think that we also have critical interests in the flow of energy, which I think is also well in hand, but is a critical interest. We also have critical interests in the security of Israel, and we have critical interests in nuclear nonproliferation. Those are the sort of four critical interests that have been generally articulated. I can see it's very easy for me to imagine protecting all of those interests with a strategy that we've talked about, which is focused on a sort of long-term degradation of ISIS. I don't see them as fundamentally at risk at this point. It's always an effort.
Okay, let me ask if we have any Twitter questions. All right, maybe think about it. Those of you who are watching online who want to send some Twitter questions in the meantime, we're going to stick with the room. Yes, in the back there, the woman in the orange dress.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Taylor. I work with Grant Thornton. My question is for the mics as well.
I'm sorry, what do you work for?
Grant Thornton. I work with Homeland Security.
Okay, thank you.
So my question is for the mics. How long do you foresee troops being needed in Iraq and also in Syria?
I was sitting here thinking,
that's
a tough
question.
Takes that one.
I'll take it if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
No matter No matter whose strategy up here you adopt, it's many years. And we're already fighting in Iraq. And we're already fighting in Syria. It's pretty hard to stop fighting when the reasons for which you started to fight haven't changed and, in fact, have gotten exacerbated and intensified. So I would submit respectfully that the other side is talking about an indefinite war, and I'm just talking about a very long one. I think their war will last. There is no prospect that what we're doing now will ultimately contain or end this conflict. The kinds of options that we've put forth, I think, are a 2 to 3 year time horizon in Iraq and a 3 to 5 year time horizon in Syria, followed by the likely deployment of an implementation force for a peace accord, which I would support, which would have to have American troops and which would incur casualties. And that force would probably have to be there for at least another 5 years after that. So I don't have good news. That's why Duran wanted me to take the question.
Okay, the gentleman here in the gray jacket, please.
Thank you. Dr. Tai Badri from Iraqi Monitor magazine in Washington. So far, we have 5,000 fighters, Sunni fighters in Kirkuk. They're willing to work with the American, only American. And now we have another list from Salah al-Din, almost 6,000 guys. So far, these guys, they're not willing to work with al-Ibadi. Now. Probably they work in the future, 6 months from now or 7 months with Ibadi. But so far, they only want to work with
American. And so what's your question and for whom?
This fighter, they're only asking to work with American. What American could provide for them and just put Ibadi aside. Thank you.
So which team should be taking that question? The affirmative team, okay.
Well, that's great. I mean, that is exactly how I understand the problem. We have significant manpower in waiting in Iraq to work with us if we'll make the decision, and we will arm them, train them directly, and work with them. One of the problems with what Senator Murphy said is basically his alternative is a non-alternative. Why? Because the Ibadi government doesn't make the decisions in the security sector in Iraq. Iran makes those decisions, and it's taken over the security sector underneath the nose of the government. We could give billions of dollars for some kind of economic incentive program to the government, and they would pocket it, and Iran would still reap all of the spoils because the Iranians have a gun to the head of the government.
Would either of you like to respond to that, Senator?
Well. So how on earth does that solve the problem in the long run? To have people that are willing to fight say that we have absolutely no faith that we can do that in conjunction with the central government in Baghdad, and so the Americans need to send thousands of troops here to partner with us. Right? That will get you a temporary local victory or regional victory, but it doesn't solve any of the underlying long-term problems. And it's why I view the surge not very differently than the terms in which Jeremy used. It was successful on its terms for the period of time that it was there. But when it wasn't there, and I would argue that the transition was lacking for a lot of different reasons, but the minute that the surge wasn't there, all of the military and economic stability was gone. And so an offer from local fighters to only fight next to Americans really doesn't get you any closer to the time in which they are willing to fight with those that are actually leading their country.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, and we still need to have time to wrap up the closing arguments on both sides. So I just want to remind you that the polls are open once again, and the same question applies. We are particularly interested in those of you who might have changed your opinion from before and after hearing these remarks. So should the U.S. put boots on the ground to fight ISIS, you can vote again now. And reminder that the voting is only going to remain open until the second that the last speaker finishes. So remember to vote. Okay, so Mike O'Hanlon, you're up first. 2 minutes, and I'm going to be timing it.
And I'll try to go even faster, because I want to just be very stark and direct on my conclusion, which is that we've tried all sorts of options in the Middle East in the last 15 years. We've tried 100,000-plus troops, and that didn't work so well. And whether the surge worked or not, the overall enterprise was obviously far too difficult with far too little payoff for the United States. And now whatever gains we achieved are largely lost, or at least in great peril. We tried doing almost nothing, which was our strategy in effect after we helped defeat Gaddafi in Libya. President Obama himself has acknowledged that he made a mistake in not trying to do more there. We've done virtually nothing in Syria. We've always tried to slow down our even covert aid programs. So the past, the history doesn't really help us too much. And I think we need to think about middle ground options. And they should be very, very intensively scrutinized. And just because they sound like Clinton triangulation doesn't mean they're good ideas. I'll concede that point, even though I'm trying to propose one tonight. And let me just simply sum up by saying on Iraq, we have a government that is much better than the one before, that at least has the right instincts on political reconciliation, that has at least some pieces of its army holding together. And thankfully, with our limited application of air power, President Obama's done a very good job of figuring out how to do that in a timely way. At least three-fourths of the country is not under ISIL control. Too much of it is influenced by Iran, yes, but fundamentally, three-fourths of the country is okay. What we need to do now is help the Iraqis take that other one-fourth back. The strategy that we've been following for the last year plus, it worked pretty well at first. It has petered out. It is not working now. We need to do somewhat more. There is a definable path ahead that's specific and limited, and we should get on with it. I'll focus on Iraq in my conclusion and stop there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. All right. So triangulating or not, Mike claims to be staking out the middle ground. So, Jeremy, we're now going to hear your closing remarks.
Thank you. I appreciate Mike's efforts, you know, not to make the same old mistakes and to make, you know, new mistakes. And I think that we see in this sort of effort, and we see actually in a lot of the presentations today, actually, I think at one point in the middle, in one of Mike Duran's interventions, the probability, the possibility of mission creep the operation that they're proposing. We have heard at the beginning of all of these operations, essentially, that, you know, we will be out in 3 months, a year, 3 years, whatever. And then every time as things go badly, the same arguments are sent back to us. And they say, well, no, we have this vital interest. We can't let it fester. We have devoted too much to stop now, so we have to escalate. We have to surge. We have to put in more troops. And the truth is that we don't see any path through this. And we can see that as we sort of struggle with military disputes among actors on the ground that we don't really understand, that we can change the dynamics, but that we don't have the political engineering capacity to really create the political reconciliation that is necessary. And we have to live with that. And I think that this gets to one of the critical points that we've all hit on, which is the question of our allies. The fact of the matter is that what's going on in Iraq and Syria is not fundamentally about the United States. We are neither the problem nor the solution to what's happening in that area. And our allies and our enemies alike all have their own agendas. And broadly speaking, they are not our agenda. And they will follow those agendas much more strongly than we will, because it's their place. They are the local actors. And I think that if we think that through the application of military force, we are going to bend the agendas of even our allies, much less our enemies, to what we want, I think we have not learned the right lessons from the last 10 or 12 years in that region.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy. So Jeremy says it's not about us, Mike Duran. Convince us that it is.
No, I actually agree with, again, like Mike said, I agree with 90% of what Jeremy said. It's the last 10% that's problematic. There's a conversation that doesn't take place in Tehran when they look at, or in Moscow, when they look at what's going on in Syria. They don't say, we don't have the capacity to influence what's happening. We don't really understand this place. We shouldn't try to do anything. They have doubled down on their ally, Assad, time and time again, as he has carried out horrendous butchery, uprooting, as I said, 10 million, something near 10 million people, killing 250,000, creating a problem that is going to be with us for years and years, for a generation to come. And as we have pulled back and done nothing, they have been emboldened to continue that support. And as they have been emboldened, our allies have seen no option but to intervene in ways that are detrimental to us. We can absolutely influence the agenda of our allies. We can generate allies who are willing to fight on the ground, to put their lives on the line in place of our own if we will support them. That was the experience of the surge. All of the men who led, the Iraqis who led forces on the battlefield together with us in the surge are now dead because we pulled back and we didn't support them. We can influence our allies, we can generate allies, and we can influence our enemies. Where I do agree with Jeremy is when he says that there's no clear way out of this. There's no clear solution. We're going to have a chaotic Middle East for the rest of our lives. The question then is, in a chaotic Middle East, how do we generate tools that allow us to protect our interests and protect the interests of our friends with a minimal amount of U.S. force? That's the question that we need to be asking ourselves.
All right. So Mike Duran says that the U.S. has to serve as a bulwark against Iran and Russia. So, Senator Murphy, we're going to hear from you last. Imagine that you're delivering your 2 minutes on the Senate floor, except if cocktails were served on the Senate floor. So think that way. And I just want to remind the audience that this is it. This is your last chance to vote. So take it away, Senator.
My skepticism about combat troops in the Middle East has its foundation in this simple premise that America is empirically terrible at influencing political stability in the Middle East with the blunt force of American military power. That's the lesson of the last 15 years. I heard plan after plan, rewrite after rewrite as to how we were going to do better, get things right in Afghanistan and Iraq, and virtually none of them came true. And why is that? It's because you don't beat a tactic with a navy. You don't defeat an ideology with an air force. You don't stamp out economic dislocation with an army. And this debate that we're having here, which I'm thrilled to be a part of, is at the same time the problem and the solution. It's the solution because we're having a really amazing open debate about our options, one that I hope that we have in Congress. The reason I was late is because we were in the Foreign Relations Committee having a members-only debate over whether or not we should actually authorize this engagement in the first place. That's a ridiculous debate to be having. It's our constitutional obligation to debate this. But we don't because it's tough, because it's hard, because the thorny issues that we're confronting here aren't easily solved by a bunch of politicians. But this debate that we're having is the problem because it perpetuates this mythology that the only relevant question about how we solve problems abroad is whether or not we deploy troops or not. There's a whole nother set of interventions, not just with respect to how we stamp out ISIS, but all of the other enemies around the world. We talk about in Ukraine only whether we arm or don't arm the Ukrainians. We've got to shift this conversation to all of the other ways in which we can conduct ourselves, whether it be supporting economic development in at-risk regions or starting to actually talk the talk and walk the walk when it comes to the values we preach around the world. There's a much more robust conversation that we can have about how we defeat ISIL and how we protect America abroad.
All right. So Senator Murphy is urging us to think of alternatives to the actual question that we're debating today. All right. So that'll be for one of the next debates. Passionate, riveting, exciting. We'll see whether it was convincing. Thank you so much, gentlemen. The polls are closed. So I'd like to ask the audience and the panelists to stay in your seats while we're tabulating the votes. And I will be back with the envelope shortly. Okay, folks, the moment you've been waiting for. I do have the envelope here. All right, so the moment you've been waiting for. Drum roll. Before the debate, here is how the audience voted. 35% of you felt that we should send in U.S. ground troops to fight ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and 65% of you were against. All right, after the debate, let's see it. After the debate, 31% thought we should send in ground troops, and 69%, so a higher number, believe that we should not send in boots. Okay. So an already weighted in favor of the negative side, they gained 4 points from their already very strong lead that people had as a preconceived notion coming into the debate. Now, the thing that strikes me the most looking at these numbers is how different this room and our viewers online are from the norm in America, because the basic polling we've seen, not last year, but since January this year, has turned. Well, we've got a whole series of polls, the Quinnipiac poll that Mike Duran referred to, and a number of others, where, you know, as recently as a couple weeks ago, we have a CNN poll and, the Quinnipiac poll and a number of others that show Americans favoring ground troops. And so I'm wondering whether that's because they haven't heard the arguments. Are they not as informed as the people in this room, or what? Or is it the way that the questions are constructed, which is what the senator had suggested, that it may be the way that the polls are designed, that it's pushing the answer in a certain direction? And I'm also struck by, you know, the White House, like any White House, is concerned about polls and is concerned about what the American people think. So I'm wondering if they have their own internal polling that is reassuring the president that Americans don't want boots on the ground, even if some of the public polling is showing otherwise. So we would also welcome to hear your thoughts on those, on why the numbers came out this way. So feel free to tweet with the hashtag Brookings Debate, and you can tweet at Brookings Inst or at Brookings FP for foreign policy. And I just want to thank everyone for turning out tonight, this, like, you know, packed audience, and sticking with us all this time. And for those of you watching online, we are really excited that this was the inaugural debate. And we think it was fun. So we hope that there are going to be more like this. And we'd love to hear your feedback on how it went tonight. Thanks. Good night, everyone. All right.